Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. The University of South Dakota honors 200 years of Mary Shelley's novel Frankenstein with the Frankenstein 200 Symposium today and tomorrow at USD in Vermilion. Featured guest is Joel Pache. He's a professor of English at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. He's an expert on British and transatlantic romanticism. He also serves as associate editor of the journal Symbiosis. He's authored books and articles and chapters on romanticism in the Americas and on Black romanticism. And not incidentally, he's also a reggae musician. Joel Pache, welcome to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me here, Lori. It's great to be here.
We could spend the entire segment just talking about you and some of the interesting things that you do, blending literature and music. But let's start with Frankenstein, because that's why you're in Vermilion. And I'm wondering, you know, a novel 200 years later, how much has our perspective changed? Has it been totally diluted into the popular culture of today? Or does it stand as its own as a piece of literary fiction even now?
That's a great question to start with. And the answer in many ways is yes to both. Just the other day, I was in the store getting Baby Bell cheese, and right on the cover of it was the creature staring back at me. So Frankenstein is pervasive in our culture. In Black Panther, recently released, The character Killmonger is referred to as a monster. So Frankenstein is very much alive and well and with us, both in the popular imagination of the creature as well as Mary Shelley's wonderful novel turning 200 this year.
So when you look at a character like Killmonger, and for folks who haven't seen the movie, he's a man. He's who has sort of been transformed by his situation, his childhood, his culture. Is that an effective connection to use that word monster, and sort of make that tie to Frankenstein, which has a very sort of different origin for that monster?
Another wonderful question. And yes, the connection is there because it's the way the creature is treated that makes the creature monstrous. And of course, the word monster sharing that root with admonition, meaning a warning. So in Killmonger and the creature, there's this warning to society about how we treat each other. And in a day where cyberbullying, for instance, is quite pervasive, it remains with us, this idea of treating one another very well. So that is the connection between Killmonger and the novel.
Mm. I've only read Frankenstein once. There's so much suffering in this book that I actually find it almost agonizing to sort of read. How many times have you read it, and how has it changed for you over the years as you revisit it?
I've read it quite a few times. I haven't counted, but it really is interesting that our sympathies can change with the novel we're reading. It's like even the topography of the novel, where once there was a stream, we revisit the novel and we find it's a dry riverbed. And of course, the novel hasn't changed, but we have. And what's fascinating to me is that I identify with the creature, and society as a whole identifies with the creature so much that we've renamed the novel for the creature, not for Victor, who's the creator of the creature. So the creature is now Frankenstein.
Yeah. And that's significant, isn't the fact that the creature is nameless? Talk a little bit about that, because I'm sure you've thought much and probably taught much about the sort of namelessness of this creature.
It's so important. Mary Shelley denies the creature a name throughout the novel, and that becomes hugely significant because the creature learns language and learns that language is situational and relational, how we relate to family and friends, and the creature has no one to whom he can relate, and so his namelessness in many ways represents his silence. And it's very interesting to connect it to yet another film today, The Shape of Water by Guillermo del Toro. The two characters in that who are silent throughout have the deepest connection. So somehow Shelley is able to turn the creature's namelessness into a powerful claim for identity in a language that denies him a place. And especially that's very relevant now as we look at the words we use to refer to different groups of people and how those words can sometimes hurt or marginalize or alienate. So Shelley has us thinking about this 200 years ago in the English language.
Right. Is she first with some of these themes that she created in this novel? Is she one of the first authors who left something that we can acknowledge still to this day and recognize it? Or is this part of something at her time that she was tapping into that was done by other authors?
She is, in terms of as a woman writing science fiction, she is first. She is one of the first authors of science fiction. And of course, in Gothic, there are other women writers, Anne Radcliffe writing at the time. She is also picking up on something that's in the Atlantic imagination at the time, which is the idea of human rights. So the Enlightenment, directly preceding the time she's writing, talked a lot about reason. But in the period she's writing in, human rights come to the fore, particularly a lot of Black Atlantic writers, a lot of writers who were formerly slaves, who learn English, who gain their freedom, who begin to talk and bandy about this language of human rights. And they talk mm-hmm. about being nameless, about having to take on the names of their masters. And so Shelley really is picking up on a lot of these narratives about identity, about civil rights, about laying a claim to equality in a world that is attempting to deny that very claim to you.
Hmm. Her parents are abolitionists, aren't they?
Yes, her parents are abolitionists, and she and her husband do not put sugar in their tea to protest the plantations where sugarcane is being made in the Caribbean. Her husband is also a radical proto-Marxist vegetarian, so there's a lot of radical thinking surrounding Shelley as she's writing this novel.
She is nameless as an author in the beginning, correct? I mean, this is published not as something that she has written. It's published anonymously. How does that tie in not only to the culture of the time, maybe with her being a female author, for example, but also with the novel itself and this notion of namelessness?
Exactly right. She is denied a name. There's a silence there surrounding her as well. And it's fascinating how society responds, because everyone immediately assumes it's written by a man. They assume it's written by her husband. And she has to justify herself in her 1831 preface to the novel to talk about, in her words, how she, a woman, came to dilate upon such a horrible idea. So this idea that a woman would not be capable of writing a Gothic novel, utterly absurd here in the wake of Twilight, but in Shelley's time, she really had to make a name for herself. And in a sense, the creature begins to haunt her just like it does Victor, because people make assumptions about her after having written this novel. So the ideas of sensibility and delicacy surrounding femininity at the time, she really breaks through that glass ceiling with this novel.
She has to answer for her own imagination.
Exactly right. She refers to the novel as the creature, so she's the first one to do it by calling the novel her hideous progeny, and she bids it go forth and prosper, sounding a bit like Dr. Spock before Star Trek.
It's successful right away, isn't it? I mean, it's immediately something that people are reading and talking about.
Right away, it's successful. There become adaptations on the stage, and then suddenly in England, the members of Parliament are debating slavery, and all of a sudden, they start referencing the novel, and they start referencing revolutions in Haiti. So the idea of the novel in terms of people advocating for rights, and if rights are denied and people are ill-treated, violence could result, it immediately catches hold. So there's several adaptations in plays in her lifetime. So the novel really does remain very popular from then right up to the present.
Hmm. I think that you know, much is made about the story of sort of the contest and this group of people who, you know, gathered on a rainy night to do some writing. And I want to talk a little bit about that. But first, when we talk about, you know, what's happening in Haiti and slave rights and namelessness, we also risk getting away from who she was as a person and her life experiences, because as an author, when I talked of the suffering and we talk about her imagination, she's a mother, and she's lost children, and she's suffered quite a bit as a very young person as well. Do you see her pouring that sort of suffering and that death with her miscarriages and the death of her children onto the page? It feels palpable to me.
That's exactly right. There's no question. Her mom dies days after she is born. So, of course, this idea of a corpse being brought back to life and haunting someone, she is stitching parts of her mom's work into her own work and creating this quote-unquote hideous progeny of a monster. She has lost a child by the time she writes this novel, and her husband's former wife commits suicide. Later on, of course, after the novel is written, she loses her husband, her sister commits suicide. And of course, in the 1831 version of the novel, in the preface, these ideas begin to add on to each other. So she has experienced immense suffering, and her mom talks about the suffering of being a woman in a place where rights are denied to women. And so there's this intersectionality where Shelley begins to see through her mother's writing and her father, William Godwin's writing, and her husband's writing, this intersectionality between, if you deny rights to women and you deny rights to slave, there's a commonality there. There's a bond that can be stronger if these groups together rally for equal rights. So there's both her own life as well as her plea for those who are marginalized coming to the fore in the novel.
Tell us the story, and if you're just tuning in, my guest is Joel Pache. He's a professor of English at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire, and he's at the University of South Dakota in Vermilion today for the Frankenstein 200 Symposium. Tell us the story, for those who don't know, of how this book came to be, the original sort of gathering of writers and the challenge that was set forth. It's still interesting after all these years.
So Mary Shelley and her husband Percy and her sister Claire Claremont leave England, and there they join the celebrity Lord Byron in Lake Geneva. In the Midwest, we always think of Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, but of course the original Lake Geneva. And there they gather with the Dr. Polidori, and they read ghost stories to each other, and they spend these nights in this beautiful, and days in this beautiful, sublime landscape. And so Lord Byron has this idea that they'll all think of a story. And Mary Shelley has been very silent. She's just been listening to these conversations among these brilliant men, and she hasn't found a voice. And suddenly, after this ghost story contest, it's soon clear who the most brilliant one of them all is. Mary Shelley speaks, and she speaks with many voices. The polyvocality of this novel becomes this beautiful testimony to just how much she has to say. So its origins in the ghost story writing contest are very exciting. And I hasten to add, there is a ghost story writing contest associated with the Frankenstein 200 Symposium. So we are hoping history.
And the lesson, yes. The lesson that is show up and do the work, you know, do the writing, because she did. don't just say, I think that sounds like a good idea. Actually do it. Interesting. who came after her? When you talk about female, science fiction writers or male science fiction, like, who did she influence in the writing world that you think can be tied sort of directly back to Mary Shelley's influence?
So interesting. So much of what we consider original and classic American literature is so influenced by Mary Shelley, Edgar Allan Poe, of course. And then with Hawthorne, if we think of the judgments placed upon Hester and how she takes that A, which means adulteress, and it shifts to mean angel and able, that same shift happens with the creature as the creature goes from being the slave to becoming the master. So this idea of how we brand each other with identities and discrimination gets taken up by Hawthorne. And then, of course, much later, The Handmaid's Tale, we can talk about, of course, I've mentioned earlier, the Twilight series. There's also a great work, Oryx and Crake, which deals with the creation of humankind by Atwood. So there is quite a long continuum, I would say continua, of men and women both writing about science fiction that have been influenced by this work. And most recently, I would also say the film Get Out also is a direct link back to Frankenstein.
Interesting. I haven't seen that one. I'm scared to see that one. I have to like close my eyes every once in a while. I don't do it. What is a good version of the original novel to read right now? I mean, I'm sure there must be new editions coming out with the 200th anniversary. Is there the one that really looks at Mary Shelley herself and what her original intents were, or will any kind of version do? Are you finding good annotations out there now?
Yes, there's an exciting version created by MIT where the scientists annotate it, which is great to see how they're still relating to the research that Shelley had done for this novel. But I have to shout out the Bedford Critical Edition edited by Johanna M. Smith, because it's amazing. In addition to giving us the text of the novel, it also gives us a lot of the text that Shelley was reading, and then we get 6 critical responses by scholars relating the novel to all sorts of different approaches to literature. So that one is very exciting. Christopher Stampone edits part of it where he updates it by showing exactly what Shelley was reading just as she was writing this novel. So exactly what texts or bodies of text she is stitching together into the corpus of this novel. Very exciting.
And you know, some of those are, it's a book about books in some ways, as the monster also learns to read and sort of gets his education that way.
That's exactly right. One of my favorite moments in the book, this idea when the creature is reading. And so here we are as readers. We have our act of reading being mirrored by the creature reading. And Shelley gets this from actually early Black Atlantic autobiography, where in these slave narratives, there's something called the talking book, where the slave will first pick up a book and hold it to his ear or her ear so it will speak to them. And soon they learn that with their own books, they can speak powerful messages of abolition. And Shelley also, through these talking book moments, by mirroring our act of reading, she controls our sympathies and sensibilities and shapes them so that we see this monster, even as it becomes increasingly violent, to be somehow more sympathetic to us.
When people make connections, you mentioned the MIT version, scientists annotating it. When people make, you know, references to the atomic bomb or to artificial intelligence or to things or cloning or, you know, things that we're creating today, are they missing the point of Frankenstein, or are they getting the point of Frankenstein still after all this time?
They are exactly getting the point. It's fascinating to me that Cambridge University, the endowed chair for Stephen Hawking, his number one warning to us is about artificial intelligence. It's like the Matrix suddenly has come to life, which of course we could relate the Matrix to Frankenstein. So we are picking up again on that idea that the monster means warning, and Shelley is warning us. There's also a graphic novel coming out in March. Next month, Victor Laval's Destroyer, in which a black woman scientist, her son gets shot by a police officer, and she resurrects him with technology as the Frankenstein creature. So, and the son actually eventually does battle with the Frankenstein creature. So this novel is coming back to life in very important ways, not the least of which are the scientific ideas and approaches we're taking to the novel.
I want to close with just a little bit about you, because as I mentioned in the introduction, you have literature, music, this sort of great teaching, this great conglomeration of art and life. How do you find, as an artist, as a teacher, as a musician, that you kind of balance all this and create something that works for you?
I really have to say, my students and my colleagues keep the ideas fresh. It's so wonderful to be in the classroom, all those synapses firing on one text, and it really is the classroom which becomes a space that I can achieve that equilibrium. And I'm very thrilled events like this one, where we have over 150 guests to come and talk about literature. That is just so thrilling. And I really view the two, to use musical terms, as a call and response. So the one calls and the other responds, as we respond as readers to each other and of course to music. So thank you so much, Lori, for that question and for having me here on your show today.
We really appreciate you stopping by. It's the Frankenstein 200 Symposium. It's today and tomorrow at the University of South Dakota in Vermilion. You can find it online. We'll put a link up to all the events on our website as well at listen.sdpb.org. My guest was Joel Pache, professor of English at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. He's a featured guest for the symposium. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Laurie.